Thanks for listening to The World We Deserve, the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's True Detective Anthology, brought to you by Bald Move. This conversation covers Season 1, Episode 3, titled The Locked Room.
From the dusty mesa, her looming shadow grows, hidden in the branches of the poem.
While out with his wife at a bar, Marty spots Lisa with another man. Later that night, he shows up at her house, drunk and angry. He breaks in and he threatens the man with criminal charges and physical violence. Meanwhile, the detectives have tracked down the pastor of last episode's burned-down church, but the investigation is at another dead end. Desperate and running out of time, Russ digs through old cases and finds one of a murdered girl who has a spiral tattoo just like the one on Dora Lang. They discover that the girl's boyfriend was a man named Reggie Ledoux, who, coincidentally, was a cellmate of Charlie Lang. Ledoux has skipped parole, and so they have their first suspect. So, after having seen episode 3 of this first season, what do you think?
I am madly in love with this episode and the series, as I have always been.
Already?
And no, I mean, I told you from the very I was sucked in, and you know, this debate about religion and what its effects on society is like mother's milk to me. I loved it all. And at the same time, the conspiracy and the murder case they're trying to blow open gets like a just really, it feels like the scope expands. And also the other mystery, which I guess that's, I didn't articulate this in the first episode. I talked about how this is different in police procedurals and that, yes, you are investigating this mystery, that you are trying to work out what actually happened. But there's also a mystery about the detectives themselves and whether they're reliable narrators and whether you're getting is something is true or not and all that, which I find fascinating. And here is a great example of an episode where you have this man that in the first two episodes, especially in the first episode, you've got solid family man, has conventional values, conventional worldviews, and as seen as a higher functioning person. And you have this other person who has these radical opinions and these radical nihilist thoughts, and he's seen as a self-destructive, crazy person.
Yeah.
But as we go further in the series, you start to question, who is the crazy one? Marty engages in insane behavior, insane, crazy, risky, self-destructive behavior.
He does, yeah.
And easily worse than anything we've seen Russ doing.
As far as that mystery goes, we'll get right back to the insane destructive behavior.
Yep.
But the mystery is set up visually too, which I really like. The difference between how Russ looks while he's investigating this thing and how Russ looks while he's being interrogated or questioned is so stark that you have to go, how did this man get to that place? How did Rust of 1995 become Rust of 2012, you know? So visually, they set up a mystery, which I thought was cool. As far as Marty, I mean, very much our perception of his character has changed over these past few episodes. And at this point, I feel like the most poignant question of this episode is, are you a bad man? Rust answers that affirmatively. Yes, I am, but we need bad men like me to keep other bad men from the door.
Right.
That's what he says. Now, I don't know that I would totally agree with him. Maybe he has more information and he understands that he is bad.
So that's interesting because like it's something I was thinking about when I was driving around today is I talked about how badass it was that Rust came in and just smacked those dudes at the toolbox. However, from a policing standpoint, that's terrible.
But I feel like maybe from a moral standpoint, it's not. He's trying to get to the bottom of this. And I don't know that that justifies that action.
Sure. That's the thing.
But it's like, certainly something to consider, right?
You know, it's like, you know, we all kind of agree when we're watching Batman, or in this case, True Detective, that
the Batman's a good guy.
The Batman's a good guy, and he has good motives, and he's doing all these things that are society doesn't approve of and accept and are outside the legal system because it's going to a greater good.
The end justifies the means.
But one thing that's fascinating about True Detective is, you know, that's why I say about unreliable narration. If you just took what Marty's statements to the police about everything he said about family and all that stuff, you would think that he was this fine, upstanding, moral, a good father, a good husband. As we go along and we see that that's not accurate at all, which also, I think, makes us question everything that we are finding out about the present. Now,
definitely,
I think
yeah.
the thing that I've started to decide in this episode was that the things we can see with our eyes and hear, like there's not false narration into when Russ says, hey, let's talk about Reggie Ledoux. that they're going to show us these past events through his eyes. I think when we go back to the past, we're actually seeing what is actually happening.
It seems like.
And then
it.
We see the men spin on it in the interrogation room. Whereas in the first two episodes, I started thinking, I wasn't sure whether when Marty kicks off a flashback, if we are actually seeing things from his perspective. And then, you know, it's going to be like one of these he said, she said type things that by the end, you'll get a 360 degree view. I don't think that's true. I think that.
Well, the hallucinations are a wrinkle, right? I mean, literally what Marty's seeing is not the same as what Rust is seeing.
Just like that. Ow. case closed. You're right, because the sky doesn't turn to jam and sparrows don't have a murmuration that looks like a occult symbol in the sky.
They do play with the point of view, right? Like, I mean, obviously it's not Rust's point of view when he goes to his mistress's house and threatens to beat the shit out of the guy she's sleeping with.
Marty.
Marty's viewpoint.
Yeah,
so it does switch back and forth.
But would you also say that you can kind of overlook that wrinkle hallucination loophole by saying that at least Rust is aware that he's hallucinating?
And I think so.
He identifies those as such.
He does. And the show identifies them to us as an audience, right?
Yeah.
Like that's, I think, the most important thing is that we as an audience get communication on that. And they've been doing that consistently, I think.
Yeah. Like even like.
Except for maybe the little girl, that was a little confusing. But I think you're meant to think that that's a hallucination.
And also, like, if you look at that in context of everything we've seen before, is when Russ sees that little girl, he immediately asks Marty, do you believe in ghosts? Which if we context that with what we learned in this episode, that's kind of like, I think, the creators of this suggesting that if we were privy to this conversation, we'd then say that as like, the Rust is seeing something, he knows it's not real, and he's commenting to Marty and also us as the audience to let us know.
I think you're right.
That's not just some random girl standing on the corner. It's actually either him hallucinating how old his girl would be at this time, or...
Yeah.
You know, one of the victims, I still don't know. We have enough information to say definitively, but it does seem that they're playing consistent when Rust has a hallucination that he lets us as an audience know that isn't real.
And this episode does a lot with that. You know, I mean, Marty is straight up lying most of this episode, not only to himself, but to the detectives who are investigating. He's telling them things that simply aren't true.
Yes.
And we see that in the flashbacks, which we're taking as canon, I guess, of what happened in 1995.
Yeah, that's what I was always worried about watching the show. It's like, will we see something that Russ sees because he does hallucinate, and then we see it from Marty's perspective, and it completely changes how we perceive
the case. If they had conflicting views of what happened in 95, that would be, yeah.
Yeah, but it seems like Russ's hallucinations are, for the most part, fantastic enough that you kind of question, even like the little girl, like we knew something was wrong about that.
Sure.
But the fact that he called it out is like, oh, do you believe in ghosts? It seems to make explicit. So as long as I can trust the filmmakers, you know, Pizzolatto and Fukunaga, as long as I can trust them that they're not going to fuck with me on that, then I'm fine.
Okay. I think so far we're good.
But there's enough tension about that it was something that I was still kind of like going back and forth, and I wasn't annoyed. I thought it was interesting. And I think it's cool. And I've seen some movies, I can't think of any offhand, where they play with the idea of for your perceptions. And like, I guess Sixth Sense is a perfect example.
Okay.
Of, you know, them showing us things that are not real, but in a visually consistent manner. And then later showing us the reality of it from an objective external third person view that shows us how those things. So it's like, and that didn't feel like a cheat.
What's the magician movie with Christian Bale in it?
Oh, The Prestige.
Prestige does that too.
It's another, that's Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, he likes to fuck with the audience.
Yes, he does. But in a way that feels fair and intellectual,
totally
valid. Whereas, like, you know, I'm always bitching about The Usual Suspects at being the opposite case. Now, some people found that enjoying. Or they found that reveals a lot of enjoyment. I felt like anger and hostility.
I think that makes you a bad man.
Yeah, well, you know, we need bad men to keep bad filmmakers away from the cinema.
See, that's the other question here is, what is it that actually makes you a bad man, your actions or your thoughts? If Rust's actions so far haven't shown me that he's a bad man, are his thoughts enough to do that?
Yeah, but that's again, like, you know, he hit that guy in the face with a toolbox for just refusing him to tell him something that was well within his rights. Like, that's...
Yeah, that's not a great thing, but does that one action make him a bad man?
We've all done some
shitty things.
Do we need bad cops to handle the true ills of society? That's a dangerous road to go down.
But it's a fair question.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I guess we should say is vigilantes in fiction, awesome. Vigilantes in real life, bad idea.
I think so. I will state that for the record.
Okay. All right.
Not very controversial. That's what I find so fascinating about this show going forward is the difference between the two and how that shapes who they are and who they think they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I don't know that Rust is a bad guy. I don't think that Marty is a good guy, even though he seems to think he is.
Right.
And that's the other thing, too. In this episode, we start to see that coming apart from Marty as well.
Mm-hmm.
He is, instead of being like, you don't say that shit. Like, people around here aren't going to buy that.
Yeah.
Instead, he's asking questions. Do you think you're a bad guy? He's the one starting to ponder more of these things, and he's seeking Rust's opinion on who he is and what he should feel and think.
Right. He's saying, don't say that. You can't act this way. And he's living his life that, because he says, like, hey, look, I try to keep things simple. I keep it very separate.
Yeah.
Everything's neat and orderly. And this, and like at some point, this voiceover literally, you know, you got to have rules. You got to have a system. It gives you the shape of things. And as he's doing this voiceover, it shows him breaking down his mistress's door and beating the shit out of her boyfriend. And then he asserts, I'm not a psycho. And then the voiceover resumes, you know, Russ needed a family. It's the boundaries. Boundaries are good.
Yeah, he slips right back into that.
And then they pop back with this long, like, it feels like it's 30 seconds as Woody Harrelson kind of like staring off in the distance, like he's having, which is kind of weird because you're right. He has that monologue, or he asks Rust about, am I a bad person? Or do you believe that we're bad people? But then, you know, several years later, he's having that kind of same internal reflection.
Yes, it feels like he hasn't been fully able to let go of the idea he has of himself as this good guy and this guy, this family man. He certainly seems to believe it less, but he's still espousing it to these detectives.
No, it's like one of those have your cake and eat it too types. Like, if you want family and children, you have to make certain sacrifices to have a happy, or maybe you don't. Maybe you can have an open relationship with your wife and you can negotiate all that stuff and have it. I mean, but most people don't. Most people go the route of, I want to be with you and one and only and be with you forever and ever and ever. But I also really like to fuck attractive people and I don't want to give that up. And I want to stay out the guys and drink beer. Like, they want all the good things about everything that they do in the world and they don't want any of the downsides of anything.
Sure. And I think that's a natural tendency.
Sure.
But I mean, maybe that's one of the things that makes you a bad man, you know, not being able to give that up, even though you've made commitments to people.
The fact you make sacrifices, like, you know, there's a cause, like, you can tell in these episodes that Rust is aware of the sacrifices he's made of being a loner.
Yeah.
But like he said, there's this, you know, I know who I am and I like this person. And there's a kind of triumph to that, to where, and it's weird that Rust is still, like, he's degenerated into this stringy, like, drunk all the time, not doing anything, like, and Marty still has the suit and he still looks very healthy and he's got less hair and all that stuff. But he, if you said, like, which is the homeless weirdo crazy guy, self-destructive, and who is the more integrated real human being, you'd say, well, it's Marty. But Russ seems like he's a lot more content and satisfied with himself.
He does. Yeah, he is consistent in how he views himself, certainly, with the way he acts. You know, he doesn't pretend to be anything that he's not. And I think that's, I think a component of being a good person is honesty. I don't know that you can necessarily be a good person if you go around constantly lying to everyone.
Right.
I think that pushes you toward bad man. And in that respect, I think Marty is in a worse boat.
Sure.
Than Rust, is a worse man than Rust.
And you got to be honest with yourself about who you are and what you want out of the world before you can start being honest with other people.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, it's interesting, the dichotomy between Marty saying these things and then living in a way that is completely the opposite of them. That he's being honest with himself.
I think that Rust has opened an Etsy shop that he's running out of the back of a bar where he sells tin can men.
Sure.
And he just, you know, he doesn't drink because he wants to drink. He drinks to make his product. He's not a bad man. He's making these cool things for people. He charges a little too much, I gotta say.
Does he?
$40 for a tin can man is...
Oh, wow. Well, you know, it's a lot of crap. Plus, you know, the liver damage. He's trying to save up for the inevitable dialysis he's going to need and liver transplant.
The other interesting thing about Marty this episode is that I think he is starting to change. Like I said earlier, he's starting to at least ask questions. I felt like he had a moment of clarity. Like when he goes into... inspect his mistress's apartment when that guy's there, somehow he controls himself and he comes out of that situation not having beat the shit out of someone. I felt like he had a small moment of clarity between what happens there, what he talks about with his wife in their bedroom, and then when he starts asking questions with Rust. I think there's a small progression from man who is insanely jealous, completely in denial, doesn't give a shit about how his wife feels and how his family feels and what he's doing to other people, to a man who is at least thinking about it.
Yeah, maybe that turning point is when he says, "I'm not a psycho," and he's standing around two very afraid people that are clearly looking at him like he is a psycho.
Yeah, you got to take a look in the mirror at that point and say, "I'm not a psycho, but I am acting psychotically."
And maybe
that's why he goes on to ask questions of Rust.
That's the thing. Like, he got to, like, "I'm all fucked up," and she says, "Yes, you are," and then have sex. That was the end of the conversation instead of the beginning.
It really was
the beginning of the true conversation. Maybe I'm judging him a little too harshly there, that he wasn't, I mean, I don't know. He does outright manipulate his wife left, right, and center, though. Like,
it's true.
The emotional manipulation abuse he applies on this poor woman is unconscionable.
Yeah, I don't know why, but for some reason I got the feeling that she kind of chose to end the conversation there.
She wants to believe
a small moment of growth.
Yeah, that's probably smart.
She wants to just, you know, over time erode away this barrier versus trying to get over it in one big leap. And I don't know that I have a problem with that strategy.
Okay. It's indicative of the fact that I find the mystery about the detectives as fascinating or more fascinating than the case itself, that I found it very hard to follow the breakthroughs of the case.
Yes.
And maybe we should talk about
because
that.
Because the show doesn't care that much.
Yeah. Like,
it really hasn't moved much since the very beginning.
And that's kind of the real-time narrative thing. It's like, Rust and Marty know what the hell's going on. If you don't, then keep watching. And it's very Wire-esque, because The Wire didn't really give a shit about your personal comfort or confusion either. We're throwing you in the middle of this thing and just going to pile on characters and situations and facts, and you either sink or swim. Honestly, don't care. And I got a little bit of that opinion with this, too.
Well, especially the end of this episode. It's pretty confusing.
They pull up to this old abandoned school, and they're talking to this yard worker about, you know, the school's history and his involvement with it. And Marty gets a call that Reggie Ledoux served time with the other guy who's Dora Lang's wife or husband, right? They spent 4 months together as a cellmate, and that puts him on red alert, and they go screaming off to go talk to him again because...
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that's really confusing. Like, where are they driving to? And then they show this image of the guy in his underwear with the gas mask and the machete, but which is a terrifying image.
It really is. Like, that is what you think of as a person that's behind these heinous crimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre back before that was a thing.
Yeah.
When it was released, you know?
Yeah. And the voiceover, you know, that Rust is talking about this really kind of insane rambling about people wanting to die and the dream that they have. And the other thing that really hit me, and it almost like made me jump, is you're so fixated on this horrific figure striding around this unkempt yard that you almost don't even notice the devil trap until it fully snaps into focus.
Where was that?
That was
Oh, you almost don't notice.
No. So he was walking in from stage left, and then on the right in this screen, there is a devil trap right in the foreground.
Oh wow, I didn't even notice that.
Huh. Okay. Well, there you go.
Okay. So that is painting the picture that this is Reggie Ledoux, this is the guy, and it was very confusing to me that they would be racing off to grab him. And that image at the end really ties into that, but in actuality, they're going to the prison and they're rushing there because they only have a few days to break the case.
Yes. And also, we're led to believe that this is a big, this is kind of the climax of the story, because there's talking about the shoot, like, you want to hear about the big shootout when we took the guy down, and mm-hmm. even Rust is like, and now we come to Reggie Ledoux. Like, this is a big, and, you know, going into episode yeah. 4, we're right in the middle of the season. This is feeling like we're heading towards a mini climax. You pinpointed like episode 4 as being when you were really engaged with this series. But when I was watching this, I wonder, like, did you watch this and were not engaged? Because I thought, like, some of this stuff was really thought provoking, and like in the, you know, religion, society, and what it means to be civilized and all that stuff, I thought would be, it's not as bleak, it's more intellectually interesting. Were you warming up to the show? Like, what did you think when you first saw this? Was this the thing where you started to be like more engaged, or?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it opened it up to me a little bit, because I feel like, you know, the value of religion and whether or not any of it makes sense or is valid is a more interesting and useful argument to have than does existence matter? Like, nihilism and atheism uh-huh. are two very different things.
Are they?
In my opinion, yes. And one has a lot more value than the other.
One thing I've always thought was interesting is that, you know, we live in a Christian nation, not necessarily because it was founded that way, et cetera. And I know there's a lot of debate to be had there, but it's inarguably that the majority population are Christian.
Sure.
What does it feel like to be a Christian or anyone that believes in God or organized religion? Because I don't think anybody gets off easy in this episode. What is it like to watch and be a fan of the show when you mm-hmm. have one of the heroic characters laying out a worldview that seems to kind of repudiate the great religions of the world? Mm-hmm. And I would say he's handing the guy who is defending that worldview his ass. Now, if I was a religious person, maybe I would say, well, maybe it's a draw. You know, Marty would get some good looks sure. in there. Russ gets some looks in there. But then that mouthpiece, Marty Hart, that's espousing that worldview mm-hmm. is shown to be a very hypocritical, terrible human being. Like, I wonder, what is there any kind of like cognitive dissonance, or did they see
you
that
think they that turns people off?
Well, it's like, I don't know, because like I'm speaking as a agnostic that doesn't believe in supernatural things, and I love Penny Dreadful, and it's all about witches and warlocks and vampires okay. and things that don't exist and casting doubt on the rational world. And I just see that as like, well, that's just kind of like, you know, it's a fiction.
Sure. It's a little fun flight of fancy there, you know.
And then maybe that's part of my not being able to get another worldview is like maybe the religious people watching this is like, well, it's fiction. Like, you know, this is the writer. He's, if I was there as Marty, I'd give a better defense, or, you know, I'm not a terrible human, hypocritical human being, so I don't have that problem. Or I wonder if they even think about it.
No, I imagine they do think about it. I imagine they see that and they go, you know, Marty's not giving the best defense. Or if I were on the other side of this and Marty was giving a bunch of arguments that Russ just couldn't defend against. Even though there may be arguments out there that he could use to defend against that, I would be like, well, that kind of sucks because, you know, maybe I would argue it better, or maybe someone more intelligent would argue it better. And that's not a good representation of what my particular group of people believes.
It may be.
So maybe it's offensive on that level. Like,
right.
You're not doing a good job of representing what I actually believe.
I mean, what started me thinking about this is when I was watching this episode, I had this flashback to when we were out in Albuquerque at the Breaking Bad Fan Fest. You know, we met a lot of fans, and one of them came up to me. We're both drunk and we had a perfectly pleasant conversation. And he's like, you know, I love you guys and think you're great. I just can't see how you guys don't believe in God. Yeah. And he was taking essentially the Marty side of the equation, and I was taking a less cynical, less nihilistic version of the Rust thing. And okay. he made the same argument.
That's
like,
a good plan.
You got it. You know, if you don't believe in God, like, why don't you, like, you know, what's to keep you from just doing whatever the hell you want and do your own selfish pleasures and all that stuff? And I was like trying to articulate that is a very, hearing people say that is extremely scary from an agnostic standpoint. Like, you're just one lapse of faith away from becoming an axe murderer.
See, but I don't totally buy that people believe that. And I know that's offensive to people who do espouse to believe that.
Yeah.
But that is you.
We're giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Me giving you the benefit of the doubt that if you were to have a lapse of faith, if something went wrong and you stopped believing in God, you wouldn't go out and kill.
Right.
I like to believe that because I want to give you a little more credit.
Sure. It's like, you know, you've got one of, if you've got a person you know that's like all about stockpiling ammo and guns for the, you know, doomsday situation when the shit hits the fan.
Uh-huh.
It's like, are you really going to shoot your neighbors if they need food? I don't think you will. Maybe you will, but I want to not believe that about you. It's one of those situations.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a strange thing. So I don't want to tell people that they don't actually believe what they say they believe. But at the same time, I think there is a reason beyond God for people to be good.
Sure.
For people to not want to kill, to not want to disturb these societal groups that give them so much other benefit.
Well, I think the difference between like you and I was that like I really sincerely believed in my religious worldview when I had it. And it's weird because I can put myself, I remember what it felt to think those things and to be the Marty Hart in the situation, minus the adultery and the brutality of side pieces, boyfriends and all that stuff. But I can remember what it's like to feel that.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like cognitive dissonance or that I was stalking out of my mind or I was saying anything particularly crazy because it's essentially how you view the world.
Yeah.
And like, you know, how you've read a world is internally consistent to your own brain. So there's no like real problem.
That's the thing. If there's nothing telling you that you're wrong.
I will say that when I was that fundamentalist Christian, I would never watch True Detective for many reasons.
Really? Okay.
But primarily, it's like, oh, yeah, well, they're talking shit about God. So that's not something I want a part of. I don't want them shaking my faith.
Yeah. I mean, that's the difference. I never had a particular worldview.
But then again, maybe if I'm looking back, maybe my core fear was that my faith was fragile. Because if you have faith and it's based on something solid, then why would you be afraid of a television show shaking it?
Sure. I mean, does Rust say that in this? He essentially says that they're all scared and they're all pitiful and pathetic, and they like to dump that onto another person who is the preacher in this case, who can, you know, take all that from them, lighten their burden,
mm-hmm.
and carry that for them. And yeah. Psychologically, I imagine that's probably part of it. I'm not going to totally disagree with Rust here.
Right.
I think he might be onto something, but Marty definitely does.
Right.
I want to talk a little bit about the techniques that Rust used in the locked room. I noticed that he slips into full-on preacher mode here, right? He's using the exact tools.
Yep.
Unburden yourself. You are not flawed. You are exactly how God made you, things that we know Rust doesn't actually believe.
Right.
And he uses that as a tool to get into this guy's head and get a confession out of him.
Well, it also harkens back to the previous episode where Marty said that Rust had a real skill at sniffing out people's weaknesses.
Yeah.
And it makes me think, like, how would Rust interrogate himself?
Oh, man.
Because
probably go to his daughter, I'd imagine.
But how, I mean, that's the thing, like, how would he get a handle on a man like Rust's weaknesses? And I wonder if, I started thinking, like, if Rust is the bad guy. Because this episode, even though they started showing Marty as being this monstrous person, I'm thinking, this is a red herring to draw me away from a lot of obvious warning signs about Rust, because Rust is going on about, you know, looking at these dead bodies, and you know what you see in their final moments, that they welcome it, that it's relief, that they were afraid, and now they see how easy it is to let go, that, you know, it's all this dream that you had inside a locked room that calls back to the episode's title, you know, that you just dream about being person, and I'm like, fuck. And he's making all these steel fetish guys out of the, I started thinking that like maybe this thing about Rust being involved in it is on to something. He's somehow involved in the actual murders.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And if not the original murder, then maybe as a way to cope that he started acting out in the modern day, like he's snapped or something.
Okay.
That he's had his ultimate revelation about where life is and what life means, but he's too afraid to commit suicide, so he does things, he acts out in other ways. Like I said, yeah. Not sure he was involved in all the murders that came before, but I started thinking seriously. He's like, well, maybe he did.
I think snap and start
recreating these things.
I think that's a valid way to interpret that, certainly. The way that I got it is after his daughter, I mean, we know that things changed drastically for him, and that's kind of the event that pushed all of who Rust is.
Yeah.
I mean, he talked about undercover drug stuff.
Right.
That was not a good time.
Right.
I understand that.
Right.
But at the same time, the point they've been harping on is his daughter. It's been mentioned in several episodes now.
But also he said something about that his daughter spared him the sin of being a father. And he also mentioned that when they're talking about this to this girl's family, says she seems sad, Marty. And I'm like, I could see a guy whose MO is finding tragic, sad people and giving them the gift or the mercy of death.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Also,
that's creepy.
So you talked about, I've never been in a room with someone 2 minutes, didn't know if they did it or not. And he gets a sly smile and he looks at the detectives and said, how long does it take you? Or how do you feel? Like, and
does
I'm
he
like,
say that, man?
In this episode,
ooh,
yeah.
Ooh, that's creepy too.
And that's the thing that really stood out about, like, maybe he's doing this partly as a way to unburden people of their miserable lives in kind of like a Loki from Avengers way. And maybe he's also doing that as a kind of a challenge.
I mean, I guess certainly we have a lot more episodes to go. But my first question would be, what's with the ritualistic type killings then? I don't know where the ritual aspect of that comes from in that kind of scenario.
I don't know. I mean, that other thing is there's this particular vision or this particular scene where we see Russ sitting in his apartment and it's just nothing but, as Marty calls, murder porn. Mm-hmm. Just spread out everywhere, and it's on his walls, and he's looking. And I kept on thinking, like, he lives in an apartment. The landlord comes in to change the furnace filter.
Sure.
What the fuck do you think when you see that? And they play around this other fiction, like, you know, Backdraft was essentially about a fireman who turns into a pyromaniac for some, you know, reason.
Okay.
Reasons. And I just wondered, like, they're playing at that idea that you've got this lawman, this bad man that's kept the bad men at bay. What happens if he flips?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. So what do you want to talk about as far as the plot goes?
Why did Marty and his wife introduce Rust into this girl who from the moment her? I looked at her eyebrows as soon as she laid eyes on Matthew McConaughey. And I'm like, those are the eyebrows of a woman who. I can't imagine what Rust would say to fuck this up. Like, he's getting in. He's getting in.
If anybody could say it, it would be Rust. But you're right.
And he tried with the whole Cynthia state. And she found a way to flirt with him. Oh, does that mean if you feel too
double good?
Yeah. And he's like, oh. And then he turns out to be this really good dancer. And, like, what about this crazy man? Like, if I knew Rust in real life, I certainly wouldn't hook him up with women that I liked or admired or considered a friend.
So there's a weird thing between Marty's wife and Rust, right? We've established that.
Yes.
They have some kind of connection. She understands him in a way that no one else does, and vice versa, I think. She has clearly set her friend up on other dates before because she's like, oh, I hope he's not like whatever last time you hooked me up.
The other cop
you hooked me up with, he got drunk, he puked on her lap, all that stuff. And they're saying, no, this guy ain't going to get anywhere near your lap.
Even though he showed up completely wasted for their first get together and he is objectively or subjectively insane.
And you notice during this that he refuses beer, right? Marty goes to pour him a beer and he's like, no.
Yep.
And Marty's surprised by that.
Yep.
I don't know if that signifies a positive change in Rust to where he's relating more to people. The fact that he's even going on a date and showing up at this thing.
Yeah, why did he? I guess the why is because he found that, this was kind of nice when I had it, you know, this connection with this woman. So,
and I think he trusts her. He trusts Marty's wife not to hook him up with somebody who's going to be a horrible person.
Yeah.
Because she understands him a little bit.
Which
so,
also that ties into the conversation when she was trying to check up on Marty and she was trying to ask Rust whether, you know, essentially, will you cover for him or will you vouch for where he's at because I trust you. And she also, did you get the feeling that she was starting to go into an improper emotional relationship and that's why Rust is like, you need to go to bed. Marty will be there. you know, Marty will come home.
Yeah, it might be he that, or it might just be, you know, honoring Marty's wishes. Like, Marty makes it pretty clear, you need to stay the fuck away from my wife.
You don't mow another man's lawn.
Quote, unquote, mow his lawn.
You certainly don't bag his clippings.
No, you do not. He is the only one who bags his clippings.
Yeah.
I think certainly Marty suspects impropriety there, but I think Marty's prone to think that in the first place because he's doing it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he calls up, I think it's out of respect for Marty's wishes that he just kind of cuts that call short.
The other thing I thought is interesting in the dialogue, there's this really interesting scene with Marty and his wife where, you know, she's trying to break him down and get him to have a real honest moment with her.
Yeah.
And he does in classic Walter White fashion. He uses a version of the truth to really sell the lie because it seems like he's opening up to her, but he's really just using this to further his agenda of, putting her back to sleep so he can get back to fucking his side piece.
Sure.
But she mentioned something I thought was interesting. And previous episode, she said, you didn't used to be this chicken shit. And this episode, she asserts that you used to be smarter. What was Marty like 10 years ago or when they first met? And why has he changed?
They never left his room, apparently.
I'm trying to arrive at this point where Marty is in denial because of the things he's seen and he's done on this job have worn on him. And he's refused to share these with his wife and his child and has directly led to him having this emotional wall between his wife, which is a barrier to intimacy. And then he goes out and fucks these other women. But on the other hand, I don't know.
I don't know. That sounds like a plausible path to who Marty is now.
Yeah.
I imagine a job like that does take a toll on you. There is another part I want to talk about.
Yeah, there's one more that we had. I do, too. So what's yours?
The one I've got sheds a little bit of light on last week's episode and what's going on with Marty's daughters, I think.
Right. That's the same thing I want to talk about.
Okay. So last episode, there was an arranged crime scene and or gangbang, depending on your point of view. I think this tips the scales toward gangbang in this episode when we see that she is drawing scenes depicting sex between a man and a woman, and that is very disturbing to her parents. I think she has got some kind of sexual thing going on. I mean, she's discovering it. We know her mother is saying like she knows about it because she needs to know about it. I don't know what this says about the children, but I think it does say that last episode she was arranging a gangbang there.
And
at least hints at
how is this connected to the case? You know, because I think there's as you dig deeper into our spoiler segment, there's a lot of things to notice to kind of maybe connect some of these elements together. But I think you're supposed to wonder, like, what the hell?
Yeah,
it's very coincidental that, and also when you look at one of the faces of the dudes that she drew that was having sexual relations with a stick figure woman, it looks like he's wearing a mask. And that's kind of like stringy beard hair hanging down from his chin that might be like consistent with the spaghetti face man.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of interesting. But on the other hand, it's like, how in the fuck could Marty investigate something that's already inside his own family? But on the other hand, it's a very horrific thought.
Sure.
Yeah, like an inevitability. Like there's this plot moving against you. This is very Lovecraftian that you don't understand and you're going to be horrified by, but you can't ultimately escape.
Yeah. They do a hell of a job giving you a feeling in this show.
Yeah. Yeah, they really do.
And that's what honestly turned me off at the beginning. The feeling was just so dark and so dreadful and sad and full of despair that I didn't even want to watch it. And as it kind of opens up more and things become more interesting in the plot and things become more interesting character-wise, I started to really get into it. And then next episode is the moment where I go, okay, I'm in.
All right, it's time for Smelling the Psychosphere, the segment that tries to, in a spoiler-free fashion, plug you into the popular theories and conspiracy theories that were going around the internet at the time the episode is originally aired. So nothing from this information is from episodes past 103, and no one at the time of writing these theories had access to information past 103. First, I want to draw in, I apologize, a lot of this stuff is visual based, and I will show these, I will shove these into the podcast show notes with a little context so you guys can check that out. And you can get the show notes on baldmove.com. Sometimes your podcast app will show them and you can actually link to the stuff and look follow along with us. Sometimes you can't, but they're all are all on baldmove.com. First, I want to direct your attention to this police file photo of Marie Fontenot.
Okay.
All right. She's wearing a flower dress with a really pink collar, yeah. A pink. Well, you know, it's probably the late 80s.
Yeah.
That's something you could see Blossom wearing.
Sure.
Punky,
totally.
Punky Brewster.
Uh-huh.
That's Punky Brewster. That's
a haircut she could have too.
Sure. I want to direct your attention next to a image of the ghost, the quote unquote ghost that Rust saw.
Some from the previous episode, right?
Speculate it could be his daughter. Maybe she's aged up to where he thought she should be. But there is a striking similarity between the facial features, the hair, I mean, other than the bangs, between this girl and Marie Fontenot. Rust had not seen, to our knowledge, Marie before this episode. So does that feed into the theory that Rust perhaps has got some kind of drug-fueled double life, Jekyll and Hyde, that he's involved in somehow the disappearance of the girl and he's subconsciously manifesting it by seeing her ghost?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're willing to buy into that theory in the first place based on that evidence and you want to go a step further, they are about the same age. They look similar. I mean, other than the obvious haircut difference.
I would buy that they're the same actress. I wouldn't dispute it if you had a gun to my head.
Maybe.
I also wouldn't swear that
they are. It's tough to see. I want to say eye color is different, but it's tough to see the hallucination's eye color.
It is. But the hair color is similar.
Yeah.
Next up, I talked about the poem that's in the poem about Carcosa that's in The King in Yellow.
Uh-huh.
The Richard Chalmers, is that
the one that drives you insane?
The one that drives you insane. There's a lot of stanzas of that. I read one last week about the twin sons. This one is, strange is the night where black stars rise and strange moons circle through the skies, but stranger still is Carcosa. The woman that Rust Cole, she's wearing like, I don't know what you would call that, a poncho, a sleeveless poncho.
Yeah.
Sleeveless poncho hoodie. She's got black stars conspicuously up the side of her neck.
Yeah, tattoos.
And as you pointed out when we went over this before the show, she's even got stars on her sleeveless hoodie poncho.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And also, if you look at Dora Lange's diary, she actually has this part of the poem quoted. Strange is the night where black stars rise. She's drawn black stars on the paper.
It looks like she's also drawn the moons.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that's the twin suns that we talked about before.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah, you're right. They do have different...
They look like maybe like an eclipse almost. You
yeah.
know? A sun eclipsing a moon?
Yeah.
Like a sliver of a moon? I don't know.
But she's got the... And it draws comparison to the woman with the neck tattoos. And then also the quote from Rust, the king's children were marked and became his angels. Implying there might be a connection. This woman might know more than she's letting on.
She looks shady.
She does look a little shady. Yeah. I didn't think of her as shady when they interviewed her, but in the still frame with her eyes all squinty, her beady eyes all squinty, she does look a little shady.
Yeah, maybe she knows more than she is telling.
All right. One Redditor said that when he looked at the show, he noticed that Marty Hart has a very prominent ring on his finger. And he's like, huh, it wasn't his wedding ring. It's on the opposite hand. And he's kind of fidgeting with it and playing with it. And he went back and looked at the episodes. And in episode one, when Reverend Tuttle from the, you know, he's the leader of the police task force, or the guy agitating for it, when he's talking to the detectives, he is fiddling with a very similar looking ring on his hand. And in this scene, Marty is subconsciously or otherwise mirroring his body language. He's also fidgeting with the ring. And if you look at these close-ups, the ring that both of them are wearing looks to be very similar in design.
So I like that from the angle of maybe Marty is just kind of deferring to a guy who seems to be more in command here.
Because
That's something you do, right? Like when the leader of a pack does something, a lot of people try to mirror body language fit in. Yeah.
Sure. Now, another Redditor on this thread noticed that they could be Masonic rings, which is something that's fairly common for people to have.
Okay.
But also someone else noticed that the preacher Joel from the Tent Revival Church says that he suspects of the people that burnt down his church, some of the widow's sons must have wanted us off the land. Widow's sons is a Freemason reference. Now, I did not know that, but I looked it up on Wikipedia, and apparently there's, you know, Freemasons base a lot of their more obscure occult, I don't even know if they're occult, but they base a lot of their beliefs out of the biblical scriptures.
Yeah.
And I guess the architect of Solomon's Temple, his name was Hiram, was said to be a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali. And, you know, they've I guess, patterned themselves after this master architect, and they call themselves the Masons. And a widow's son is something that is referred to Masons as a whole. So you've got guys wearing Masonic rings, maybe connected to the investigation, possibly burning down a church that contains a lot of evidence for the murder investigation. I don't need to tell you how involved Freemasons are in almost every conspiracy. I'm not saying they're actually involved.
Sure.
But A number one is like Illuminati. A number two is the Masons. They're always up in there. They're always up in the conspiracy theories.
Interesting? Yeah, that's. I think that's interesting. Certainly, we get a lot of occult stuff in this show. It has a very occult vibe to it. And I think the next thing we're going to talk about is also mixed up in that. I definitely think that could be interesting.
Remember we talked about, I think it was last episode, Dora Lang. We visited her mom and she's crazy and she's talking about why wouldn't the father bathe her child? We saw something on her mantelpiece that we're like, what the fuck? That was not commented on. It's five horsemen wearing very sinister looking kind of camo ghillie style outfits with big black dunce caps on their head.
Uh-huh.
And there's a little girl standing kind of forlornly in the foreground in front of them. Someone noticed that there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 men and the one girl, and then that also matches the composition of the Barbie-based reenactment of the murder investigation / snuff film / gang rape scene.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Ken dolls around the one blonde Barbie, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 creepy-ass horsemen around the blonde little girl. Is there some kind of synergy in these theories, do you think?
Yeah.
How's that psycho-seer smelling?
I think it smells pretty good. I think if you don't draw a connection between those two, you're kind of crazy.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what it says. I don't know if, you know, the Cajun Mardi Gras is mixed up in this or the Freemasons are mixed up in this, but
the Freemasons, it's
certainly
well
interesting.
Yeah. That's the other thing. I saw on Reddit that a man from Louisiana stated that he didn't see those images as creepy because that is a traditional Cajun Mardi Gras.
Okay.
And apparently they have, and you can, if you Google Cajun Mardi Gras and do an image search, you will see tons of people dressed up as exactly that. And I guess the way it works is kind of Halloweenish for adults. Is that men ride horseback from farm to farm. And the farmers, if they're wearing good costumes, will give them meat like deer and chicken and beef.
You're cute. Here, have two candy bars.
If they're wearing okay costumes, they give them like vegetables and okra and stuff like that. If they're wearing shitty costumes or maybe none at all, they get a lump of coal or nothing. And everybody gets drunk on beer and it's supposedly good time. So
weird.
Now, I do feel like visually that's meant to be intimidating and weird. But that kind of hinges on me culturally being ignorant of what's going on there.
Yeah, I think so.
So what does that mean for the show? I feel like this is not made for people that are familiar with Cajun traditions or even Cajun food.
I think it's a general feeling that the show is trying to give you. You know, we've talked about this before. Yeah, a little bit of that creepy occult vibe. You know, stuff with stars and the King in Yellow. I think they throw things in that aren't directly connected to the plot, right? Mm. Just to give you an atmosphere. And I think that's where a lot of this stuff lies.
Okay.
But I think the occult angle is good because if you're talking about killings and you're talking about symbols on bodies and rituals and stuff like that, the occult plays a big part in what we think of when we think of those things.
Okay. Here's a non-visual thing to talk about. Speaking of Tuttle, he of the Masonic ring, the Bible Thumper Tuttle is pushing hard to have his own private, I don't know if it's his own private, he's stumping for this police task force, I guess is his brainchild, investigating occult or satanic or non-Christian crimes, to take over the investigation. He also has ties to, I think he's the the cousin or maybe the brother of the governor of Louisiana.
Okay.
So that implies that maybe he's trying to cover something up. And also we found out in this episode that he's behind these little not-for-profit religious schools for disadvantaged young people.
Yeah.
Which would provide people within his sphere of influence access to young, impressionable boys and girls who maybe are down on their luck and susceptible to kind of cult tactics.
It would. See, I think you might be leaning a little bit toward the conspiracy area here.
Uh-huh.
Because it could also be the case that this guy is just looking out for his best interest. If there's a cult going around killing people, he has an interest as a Christian religious leader.
Sure.
To have this anti-Christian task force look into it because he wants to be sure they're not coming after Christians, not coming after his people.
That's true. But on the other hand, if you're somehow involved in underground snuffering with antlers and young women, this would be having a lot of power to cover that up and shift resources around and making sure nothing comes of it. Having political cover, police cover, and access is interesting.
Definitely. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Sure, I understand. You're not wanting to take a whiff that deeply of the psychosphere. last one. This is kind of a visual Easter egg, or maybe it would be like the subliminal type of thing that the Fukunaga and Pizzolatto are trying to do to us. There's in the yellow flyer that we saw last episode, it says, "Are you lost and alone? Jesus Christ will save you. You are our family, blah, blah, blah." All of the cans, Russ is drinking nothing snooty. He's drinking Lone Star beer. All the cans are carefully staged so that the labels are rotated such that we only see the L-O and S-T from Lone Star, which spells lost.
Uh-huh.
Someone else on Reddit noticed that the flip side of that would be if you're left with the N-E-A-R from Lone Star, the near side of the can would actually spell out near. What the hell does that mean? Is Rust lost? Is Jesus Christ going to save him? Is he near?
All good questions.
Is he near? Is he near the answer to the murder investigation? Is he near the actual murders themselves? Are these just?
I mean, that ties in with the idea that maybe he's committed the murders. Yeah.
Is just this a subliminal thing to suggest that he's lost? It's just a visual thematic thing. A little fun they're having.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm prepared to say.
Okay.
I think it's probably just a visual anomaly or just having fun. I don't know. I think to fully explore that theory, you got to play the anagram game too, right?
Well,
you got to take those letters, you got to jumble them up, and you got to see what comes out of it.
Well, I mean, obviously, you got the horse cult connection. You got these guys running around in the mud. That's clear horse cult. Russ is doing all the box work.
Yeah.
He's the chore slut. I mean, it's starting to look pretty conclusive. I don't know if I've been whiffing the psychosphere too much. Or if that's
the
turpentine
if
that's the turpentine I've been huffing over here. But it's starting to look pretty good to me. Again, this is all in the show notes. So if you want to go to baldmove.com and look up this episode and click through to the article, all these links with some context will be in the article for the podcast. If you shop on Amazon, please remember to use our affiliate link at amazon.baldmove.com. You get the same great Amazon experience, and we get a chunk of Amazon's profits just for sending you their way. If you'd like to send in your feedback, you can do so by emailing it to truedetective@baldmove.com. You can find all of our content at baldmove.com and participate in our discussion forums. Keep up with our latest release schedules by liking us on Facebook or following us on Twitter.